Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, audio from the 08 election. 1908, that is. Also, political pumpkins, stolen yard signs, one man's quest for the perfect garage, and a tour of the exhibit Out of Sequence, Underrepresented Voices in American Comics. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. In an age consumed by sound bites and jabs traded between presidential candidates, it's hard to imagine an age with no campaign sound. A new CD of archived audio looks at the first efforts, 100 years ago, to pair up the views of presidential candidates through the recorded word. Jeff Bossert has more.
William Jennings Bryan and William Howard Taft never debated one another, but in 1908, one Nickelodeon operator in New York City at least tried to give that illusion, with the help of wax cylinder recordings. Richard Martin is the co-founder of Archaeophone Records.
You've got the two mannequins, right? One is Bryan, one is Taft, and then the machine is playing the cylinder, and then you play the other guy's cylinder, so you've got this idea of a debate. These were apparently pretty popular, and there's art from the period depicting it with great amusement.
In fact, it wasn't until 1960 when John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon appeared on network TV did two U.S. presidential candidates exchange views in the same room. But if Bryan had completely had his way, things may have been different.
An Ideal Republic by William Jennings Bryan, Edison Records. I can conceive of a national destiny surpassing the glories of the present and the past, a destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibility.
In 1908, about 15 years after Thomas Edison's wax cylinder phonograph made its way from the experimental stage to the nickel slot machines, Bryan, a Democrat, made the first commercially recorded campaign speech by a presidential candidate. An Ideal Republic was lifted from his acceptance speech from the 1900 Democratic Convention. It's one of 22 speeches by Bryan and Taft that's now part of Debate 08, a CD put out by Archaeophone. The Champaign-based label specializes in reviving recordings made between the late 1880s and early 1920s and packaging them with extensive booklets, putting them in historical context. Archaeophone is releasing a complete set of the two-minute speeches for the first time. The earliest Edison wax cylinders in the 1890s were used for a wide variety of recordings, songs, band music, even comedy monologues. But some found an ethical dilemma that came with the new concept of preserving speech. Patrick Feaster is a professor of folklore at Indiana University who wrote album notes for Debate 08.
What are the limits and what you can really do with that? What's proper? For instance, if you record a preacher doing a wedding ceremony, can you use that cylinder then to marry people? So, you know, using a phonograph to do political speaking for somebody was something that took a little getting used to. People weren't quite sure what they thought of that.
Feaster says running for an office with the dignity of president also seemed beneath not only recording speeches, but traveling around the country to make public appearances. William Jennings Bryan was one candidate who attempted to break from that mold. In his 1896 campaign, the man known as the Great Commoner embarked on the first whistle-stop train tour by a presidential candidate. And the recording industry decided to play a role in the campaigns of Bryan and Republican opponent William McKinley. But the cylinders made available to the public weren't the candidates' voices. They were recorded by actors, complete with staged cheering and applause. But Patrick Feaster says its listeners were more concerned with entertainment than politics.
So the idea of a reenactment of a historical episode may have seemed to them a little bit more like a Hollywood movie today, the reenacting something from the Civil War. It wasn't really that they were fooling anybody by passing off speeches, you know, that were actually done by actors, and yet it's supposed to be McKinley or some other candidate. And it was really more about giving people a particular kind of experience. You could sort of imagine that you were there listening to a speech.
And at first, there were technical limits to making a wax cylinder recording. Phonograph companies had yet to perfect a way of copying them, meaning musicians and voice actors had to spend hours in front of the device making duplicates, something presidential candidates would hardly have time to do. The recordings were again faked in 1900 when President McKinley faced Bryan for a second time. And for the next few years, when Bryan chose not to run, candidates like Theodore Roosevelt were unwilling to stoop to making a recorded address. But things changed 8 years later. Technology finally allowed for easy copying. Bryan was back in the race. All it took now is for William Howard Taft to consent to the same thing, which he finally did to avoid any perceived advantage by his opponent.
The Democratic platform recommends a tax upon national banks and upon such state banks as may come in the nature of enforced insurance, to raise a guarantee fund to pay the depositors of any bank which fails. The proposition is to tax the honest and prudent banker to make up for the dishonesty and the imprudence of others. No one can foresee the burden which under this system...
Taft's address, entitled Enforced Insurance of Bank Deposits, is one of 12 speeches by the Republican contained in Debate 08 to accompany 10 by Bryan. David Giovannone, an audio historian and one of the CD's producers, says it's odd how prevalent issues like international affairs and financial security are still taking up presidential debates 100 years later.
Taft, the Republican, is saying, look, you forced the banks to pay insurance on their deposits, and what you're going to get is lawlessness. You're going to have a lot of bankers speculating with money, and they don't have anything to lose, because if they lose, they have an insurance fund that'll pay their depositors. The government will step in. You know, that's not what the Republican Party wants to see. That's a pretty damn interesting story right now.
Other speech titles that highlight the CD's 45 minutes include The Philippines, The Rights of Labor, The Popular Election of Senators, and Rights and Progress of the Negro. The cylinders cost 35 cents each, the equivalent of $8 today, and while many would gather in one home to listen to them, Patrick Feaster says it appears people were still caught up in the novelty of the recordings and not so influenced by the message.
We generally assume they did not sell well because there just aren't many copies of them around today, and a record that sold really well, you expect to turn up a lot at antique shops and the like. I suppose it's also possible people just pitched them after the election is out of date. But the effect on the campaign is a bit of a mystery. Nobody, as far as I know, has really come up with a good answer to that one.
For Bryan to have been so taken with the idea of wax cylinder recordings, it would appear the campaign tactic didn't work. He suffered the worst of his three defeats in the race for president in 1908. David Giovannone, who spent decades compiling the set of recordings by Taft and Bryan, says it would be presumptive to assume the Edison Phonograph Company was trying to preserve the voices of great men.
They were just trying to make a buck, as, you know, with anything they recorded. Now, you will see some poetry about, you know, having the voice of the next president, no matter who that may be, on an Edison cylinder that they wrote that summer and fall. But it was a commercial operation.
But that commercial outfit that appeared to have only passing interest 100 years ago is being treasured today. I'm Jeff Bossert.
This is Sidetrack. The 2008 presidential campaign may be one of the most divisive battles in American political history. Perhaps nowhere is this divisiveness and anger felt than in the theft of Obama and McCain yard signs around the country. In Southwest Michigan, political activists on both sides say the disappearance of such signs is unprecedented. Dan Collinson and Elizabeth Meister of Long Haul Productions have the story.
My name is Bob Miller. We're at the Union Pier Campaign for Change office for Barack Obama. We distribute a lot of yard signs out of this office, and at least half, if not more, are distributed to people who come in to tell the story of how their sign's been stolen and they need another one.
Oh, you got my signs. Thank you so much.
My name is Susan Brower. I live in Harbert, Michigan.
They keep getting me.
We've always put a sign out or two, and no one has ever taken signs. This is the first time that we're having this experience.
It seems to be happening mostly at night and in every community around here.
My name is Dick Dwyer. I'm supporting John McCain in the upcoming presidential election.
My name is Sherry Lynn Galoro, and I live in New Buffalo, Michigan. I'm a McCain supporter, and I put my sign up in the yard, and one day it was there, and next day it was gone.
Both of them magically disappeared.
I was very angry.
My name is Rick Tuttle. I own a little bookstore in Three Oaks, Michigan. What I did was, instead of replacing the sign, I put a sign out that says, "Hey, you, put back my Obama sign."
Oh, we had a volunteer come in today who said that her sign was stolen, and so they put up a sign that said, "For every Obama sign you steal from this yard, I'm donating $50 more to the Obama campaign."
I have one friend who, she's replaced her sign twice now, and she's put grease on the borders of it, so when you pick it up, it hopefully will stick to your hand.
Well, my name's Leo Yovanovic. I live on Elm Valley Road outside of Three Oaks, and I decided to put an electric fence around it. There's four strands of electric wire, roughly 6x6 square, and the wires are about 12 inches apart, and there's four wires up. It ain't going to kill you, you know, but if somebody wants to touch that wire, they're gonna get a little surprised.
I'm Mary Jo Nallenweg, and I'm the village clerk and treasurer for the Village of Michiana. I had a resident come in and said that he had just seen a man over on Choctaw here in the village that was reportedly taking signs out of residents' yards and putting them in his vehicle.
I'm really hoping it's just a bunch of punk kids that are doing this, because if there's adults going out there and stealing signs, then we're in trouble.
The description was a slender white male, mid-70s, approximately 5'5", and he was driving a newer model charcoal-colored Lincoln Town Car. And they were Obama signs that he was putting into the back of his car.
I think they should be prosecuted. It's not very nice. It's not very Christian.
Mess with my sign and I'll take away your vote. That's what I'd do.
If they would just let the cops bring the guy back and just let him deal with the owner of the property, take him out bat and beat his butt or something, you know? That'd be the best way to take care of it, so we wouldn't have to go through the system.
I'm kind of disturbed by the undercurrent that seems to be running through this political campaign. I know there have always been signs stolen here and there throughout every campaign, but I haven't heard of instances like this before, so this is something new to me, at least.
It could be another sign of how divided we are and how much healing needs to take place after the election's over.
I'm about to put back the sign.
I told my wife, I said, this is the third attempt of, you know, trying to keep a sign on our property. And if this one gets stolen, then I'll probably end up sleeping in a combine with a shotgun. So, yeah, I'm pretty passionate about keeping my Obama sign.
I've been so angry about them stealing it. I don't know what I'm going to do the third time. Don't want to cry, and I don't want to get any angrier. I just want people to stop doing this.
That story on the disappearance of Obama and McCain yard signs was produced by Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister for Long Haul Productions. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. If you're a supporter of Illinois Senator Barack Obama, what would you give to be at his election night rally in Chicago's Grant Park? Massages? Computer help? Money? Romance? Well, get in line, because people are already offering those things. That's right, tickets to Obama's election night shindig were snapped up in a matter of a few hours Tuesday afternoon. Chicago has now sprouted a small but lively underground economy where tickets to the event are getting bartered, swapped, sold, and traded. Ben Calhoun reports.
Just after 2 p.m. on Tuesday, without any warning, an email went out to Obama supporters in Illinois. It said they could sign up for tickets for his election night party in Grant Park on a first-come, first-served basis. By late afternoon, they were all gone, and requests were funneled into a waiting list. Eventually, the waiting list got so long, the campaign cut that off, too.
I was working all day, and I was really too busy to even check my email. So at the end of the day, at about 6 o'clock, I finally checked my email, and I said, oh, my God, I've got to go and try to get this ticket.
Ben Hawk is 30 and lives in Chicago, where he works for an ad agency. Hawk says he's been an Obama supporter since 2004.
I saw him at the Democratic National Convention. I was watching it with my parents. And at the end of his speech, all of us were floored.
Hawk says supporting Obama was a political awakening for him. He saw his Republican father vote Democrat for the first time. And Hawk, who'd never contributed money to a campaign, ended up donating money to Obama's presidential run. Several times, actually. As soon as he saw the email about the election night rally, Hawk says he immediately put his name in and crossed his fingers.
Then I got an email back that was just a form email that says, "You have been entered into the waiting list. This is not a ticket."
Like hundreds, if not thousands of others, Hawk didn't get tickets to the Obama event. But he quickly realized there was another way. The email to people who got tickets said they would have to bring a picture ID proving they were the person who got the ticket. But the email also said everyone would get to bring a guest. The way Hawk saw it, those guest slots were his chance. He logged onto the classified website, Craigslist.
I posted a wanted a posting saying, like, I will pay for tickets to go. And I got three responses back.
One response offered Hawk two tickets. Another warned him that anyone selling two tickets was probably scamming him because the ticket winner's name would have to be on one. The third response was from a ticket holder who offered Hawk his guest spot if Hawk would agree to pay the guy $1,500.
I formulated like six different responses and then I just deleted it.
What were some of the responses?
Oh, expletive, expletive. I don't want to say it on the radio, but I was upset at first, and then I just kind of let it go.
If you search Craigslist right now, you'll find dozens and dozens of listings. As they've multiplied, the ticket seekers have made their pleas more desperate, more inventive. One person offered massages. Another offered a date, saying, quote, "Maybe it could turn into more than one night with me, you, and Obama. Smiley face. Ha ha. Who knows, right?" The ticket holders have responded by making their demands more daring. One suggests White Sox tickets. Another told people, quote, "Get creative."
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, good.
Come on in.
Maggie Sheehan is a 20-year-old junior at DePaul University. Last night, she was cramming for a big biology test and struggling with a harsh reality.
The brain is a very complicated organ.
Like Ben Hawk, Maggie Sheehan says she didn't get the email about tickets until it was too late.
I was in biology lab, so I was there for 2.5 hours. And so didn't get the email for 2.5 hours.
Biology is making life hard these days.
Biology is making life very hard these days.
After getting waitlisted for tickets, Sheehan sat down with her roommate to write a Craigslist ad trying to buy tickets. And just like Ben Hawk, they had to ask themselves, how much is it worth to me?
And I said, well, would you pay 40 if I paid 40? And she said, sure.
The two offered $80 for two guest spots. And so far, they've had no luck.
All right, so if somebody came to you and said, got two spots, we're going to give them to you for $150.
I mean, I'd love to say yes. I would love to do that, but I don't know if it's possible.
Sheehan confessed to me that she's pretty discouraged at this point, adding that she has a secret hope that a certain Chicagoan might hear her on the radio. And that was part of the reason she took time away from studying to talk to me. She even came up with a pitch.
I'll be Maggie the college student instead of Joe the plumber. You know, the average Joe trying to get her way into the election.
But the heart of all the backroom dealings isn't the buyers, really. It's the sellers. The people who got something for free and then realized all of a sudden they had something that thousands of people wanted desperately.
When you have something of value, your natural inclination is to try and get value for it. That's capitalism, right?
Adam, who asked that I not use his last name, is one of the people on Craigslist who's offering up his guest spot. Out of many people contacted, he was the only person who would agree to talk. Adam told me he knows he could get a lot of money for his guest spot, but at least for now, that's not how he's going to pick who gets his second ticket.
It's not about the money at this point. It's about who wants to be there the most and who's willing to be the most creative.
This is like a huge amount of power that you've got.
I know. I was joking to my friend the other night. The way the requests are rolling in, and I said to my friend, you know, this must be what it feels like to be a really hot chick and have people graveling at your feet all the time. on some level, I feel bad because I've got this power, and I don't want to wield it for evil, so to speak. But at the same time, it's kind of fun.
It's kind of like Spider-Man, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, right?
Right, exactly. exactly.
Adam admitted that if someone offered him $1,000, he would have a hard time turning it down. But he told me that the leading contender out of the dozen or so offers he's gotten isn't a cash offer. He said he's leaning towards a college student from Ohio who's volunteered for the campaign. In exchange for his ticket, she's offered Adam homemade cookies and free cello lessons. I'm Ben Calhoun.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Pumpkin carving has become quite a sophisticated art form. You can see everything from a pumpkin Death Star to a pulpy orange celebrity portrait. And since Halloween fell right before Election Day this year, lots of pumpkin carvers were inspired by two likenesses in particular. Kate Hines has more.
When you want to display your enthusiastic support for a candidate, you can pin a button to your coat, slap a bumper sticker on your car, tape a sign to your window, or you can do what these two women are doing. Carve a Barack O'Lantern.
I hope this doesn't break.
Watch your finger.
Okay. Now go this way.
Here.
Giselle Kuyan and Tomiko Carrier bent over a pumpkin with a paper stencil plastered to the side.
We're carving out the B for Obama in the name Obama. The O?
O is new.
The same O as in hope.
They downloaded it from yeswecarve.com, a pro-Obama webpage which provides stencils and organizes BYOP events, that's Bring Your Own Pumpkin, and they're here in a Soho loft to participate in a Yes We Carve event. But Giselle and Tomiko are first-time carvers, and some of the letters in the name Obama are giving them fits.
The O is difficult. And then when you push it out, it's kind of hard, too, because I don't know what to do, whether to push inward
in
or outward. It's breaking.
It is.
You have a crisis with the B.
The M was the easiest, because it's less curvature. So.
But their pumpkin is fairly straightforward when compared to that of an NYU student named Jessica, who is slicing away to create Obama's face.
How hard is this?
This one's very... Wow.
Her pumpkin looks a little bizarre, with a lot of seemingly random cuts that don't really add up to a decipherable design. But put a light in it, and that pumpkin is transformed.
It looks a lot better lit up.
As it turns out, good lighting is everything. And no one understands that better than celebrity pumpkin carver and Chelsea Market resident gourd artist, Hugh McMahon. He's brought two minutely detailed Obama and McCain pumpkins to display. He's created them by carving into the pumpkin's skin, and the effect is like a photographic negative. It's intricate work.
So who is harder to carve?
I would say the McCain was tougher. Getting those jowls right was a little difficult. But I think I halfway solved it. I think the Obama went smoother, but also I'm an Obama supporter. So I guess you'd say he's my favorite. I do think the likeness came out a little better on him than the McCain, but I like the McCain.
The truth is that while these carvings are remarkable likenesses, neither candidate looks particularly handsome when rendered in pumpkin. Or should I say, in funkin, because McMahon's used artificial styrofoam pumpkins for these two carvings. Obama's ears are rather large, and McCain is looking shiftily to his right. But that's a deliberate choice, because McMahon is not just carving political pumpkins, he's engaging in political commentary.
I consider Obama the optimistic candidate, where he's young and pleasant, while and McCain is worried about him over on the right. But if you remember, too, is that that's pretty much how it went on the during the debates, is McCain was always looking over at different directions, and Obama was straightforward there, giving his point of views clearly. And so I'm trying to capture that feeling in the carving.
Of course, political pumpkinry isn't unique to Democrats, and a quick internet search revealed plenty of McCain and Palin pumpkins. But there seem to be far more Obama-themed ones out there. It doesn't hurt that the Obama campaign, unlike McCain's, has a recognizable graphic, the signature red, white, and blue sunrise O. But regardless of your political persuasion, Hugh McMahon offered some tips. Pumpkin carving, like politics, is messy, so spread out some old newspapers before you start. Carve from the bottom, not the top. It makes lighting easier and preserves your design when decay inevitably sets in. And spray your finished carving with lemon juice. But most importantly, express yourself.
Get away from the triangle eyes and try to do something new and different.
I'm Kate Hine.
Still to come, an audio postcard from a line dancing teacher, one man's perfect garage, and an art exhibit of underrepresented voices in American comics. Stay tuned. Recently, independent producer Matt Pryor spent the day at the Hartville Flea Market in Ohio looking at everything from bottle caps to stun guns. The flea market is a great place to find everything you've ever wanted while getting in some great people watching.
Yeah. I got men's Ralph Lauren $75 shirts or $5 a piece.
From bottle caps to stun guns, the Hartville Flea Market has everything you need and everything you don't. 65 years ago, the flea market started out as a livestock auction, but today has grown to become one of the biggest flea markets in Ohio, attracting people from neighboring cities and beyond. Saturdays are the busiest day at the flea market, and for vendors to make their best profits, they have to put on a show, performing almost. As you walk past them, they shout at you, trying to lure you in to see their merchandise. They remind you of those old traveling tent salesmen who sell homemade moonshine and pass it off as a cure-all elixir.
I'll be right over, ma'am.
While some vendors have specialty items like baseball cards and records, others have a little bit of everything.
Tell me a little bit about what you sell here. What's your specialty? Or do you have one? Or
is it just... I don't have one. Just whatever you see here, that's what we got. Yeah.
Where do you get it all from?
Oh, man. Basically, sometimes you buy it, you know, flea markets, not flea markets, but, you know, yard sales or whatever. But other than that, you know, it's rough sometimes because nobody want to pay the, you know, whatever.
Right.
Sometimes you don't make really what you put into it.
Right.
Not only does the flea market have a variety of items, it also has a variety of characters. From vendors to buyers, and this man.
Probably about, this is my second Saturday.
Yeah.
Last Saturday was $49.19. Yeah. That's about it.
When I asked him if he had a full-time job, he told me no. He said this is what he does. He goes to flea markets and he plays for money.
When I used to live in Streetsboro, I worked at a place that distributed CDs and DVDs, but they let me go, so ever since then I've been doing odd jobs here and there. But right now this is all I'm doing, because this is all I care about right now.
Basically, this is how the flea market goes. You can find the most random items and meet the most random people. Whether you're looking for a spool of yarn or a taxidermy deer head, or just in the mood to people watch, the Hartville Flea Market has a little bit of everything for everyone.
That's okay.
Where's the garden?
That story from independent producer Matt Pryor. This is Sidetrack. Kombucha may be a health fad in the United States, but this mushroom-like tea has been around over 2,000 years. Known as the remedy for immortality or the immortality health elixir during the Qin Dynasty in China, kombucha has passed from generation to generation and from culture to culture. Now in the American mainstream, kombucha is a staple in most natural food stores. More from Lauren Bonner.
Brian Preston Campbell has a lot going on in his tiny kitchen in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. His son Ian has just finished lunch and doesn't want to follow orders. At 4 years old, he's quite a handful.
Goodbye, Ian.
In your room.
Preston Campbell's wife, Rebecca, helps Ian out of the kitchen so that her husband can tend to what looks like an elementary school science experiment. 5 big jars full of brown liquid sit on the counter. In each jar, a large gelatinous disc floats. Preston Campbell gets out a filtering tube from the cabinet.
This is what my son likes to help me with. When they say it's safe for little kids.
Preston Campbell is brewing kombucha. The strange name refers to the gelatinous blob, which is also called a SCOBY. The acronym stands for Symbiotic Culture of Bacteria and Yeast. Yes, it is alive. When fermented in sugared black tea, the SCOBY creates a beverage that tastes like hard apple cider. The concoction is known for its health benefits. Some say it increases vitality. Others have claimed it cures cancer. Preston Campbell drinks it because it makes him feel good. But lately he's been saying he can't fill any more jars. They're taking up precious kitchen space.
I call it friendship tea because you give it to your friends because it keeps regenerating. You can't get rid of the stuff fast enough.
The SCOBY mother generates a baby every 7 to 10 days, which is the time it takes for the tea to brew. The fermentation process is similar to the way milk is cultured to make yogurt. With kombucha, you get a new baby, which will be placed in the next batch of tea. The mother is usually placed in a separate reserve jar called the hotel.
Can you imagine what a jellyfish would feel like when you see it on the beach? That's kind of what it looks like.
Because the SCOBY is a living bacteria, there are precautions to consider when brewing. Foremost, cleanliness. Kelly Morrow teaches nutrition at Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington, one of the few schools in the country with an accredited natural medicine program.
When people do their own homebrew, there's potential for contamination. And they found, you know, when people have assayed what's in it, they found a variety of different things. But it's probably like fermenting anything. You know, if you make your own sauerkraut or you make your own yogurt or, you know, make your own kimchi or whatever you make that's fermented, there's probably always a risk of contamination just based on what gets growing in there.
The FDA inspects the facilities of commercial kombucha brewers for sanitation, but regulation stops there. Because kombucha is considered a dietary supplement, the FDA doesn't have to study its safety, unless people start getting sick. There isn't much clinical evidence proving the health benefits of kombucha either.
I feel like it's really detoxifying, you know, it really cleanses your system, at least as far as what I've read. It's good for kidney health. But none of these have been backed up by any FDA research, so it's really hard to say that these things actually do happen.
Lack of clinical data hasn't kept people from drinking kombucha. The U.S. experienced the first wave during the 1990s when people who drank it brewed it in their homes. Most written literature on kombucha comes from doctors and academics from Europe. But this could be changing now that kombucha has become another marketed American product.
If Oprah, you know, talks about it, then I think everybody will know about it. But I always tell my students, you got to watch Oprah and what Dr. Oz talks about because that's what all your patients are going to want to talk to you about.
It's not likely that homebrewers will start buying their kombucha from a store. For Preston Campbell, there is no comparison. Homebrewed tastes better than factory brewed, and it costs a lot less. There is also something to be said about kombucha being a catalyst for community.
Like everyone here at Bastyr, all the students are like, do you have a baby? I need another baby. You know, people are, you know, giving these jars of little slimy kombucha babies.
In Preston Campbell's case, he's got more SCOBYs than he can handle. He used to give them away on Craigslist. But with 2 kids to care for, he says it's too time-consuming to pack them up and give them away. For now, he'll continue to brew his tea and just put the old SCOBYs in the compost.
That feature from producer Lauren Bonner. Additional help on that story from Shuka Kalantari and Chad Bernhard. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Tina Foster is a line dancing instructor in Southern Maine. If you asked her, she would rather be line dancing than doing anything else. Independent producer Morgan McCarthy produced this audio essay.
The first time that you come in, you're going to walk out of here with absolutely nothing but a bunch of jumble in your head.
5, 6, 7, and walk. Right, left, and a kickball change. Walk, walk after.
I'm Tina Foster. I am a line dance instructor in Southern Maine. I was a former corporate accountant and got laid off from my job. And my husband said, go make your dance full time. So that's what I do full time now.
Angela, you can do this one, honey. Come on out here. Step touches. Right, left, right, right, left, right, left, and walk.
Now I've been teaching since 1999 and can't think of anything better to do with my life. If you can count to 8 and you know you're left from your right, you're halfway there. The rest of it is stick-to-itiveness. You just have to keep on plugging at it. You just can't say, nope, can't do it. You need to keep trying. I've taught some of the most uncoordinated people in the world how to line dance. There are 5 basic shuffle steps, jazz boxes. Off of those basic steps, you build other steps. It's a lot of heel switches. Doing a step lock is the same thing as a shuffle, but your feet are in a different position. Shuffle and rock and shuffle back and rock. And you do a lot of hip bumps, a lot of hip bumps in this dance. As everyone goes along, they learn the step, and then they'll learn the modifications of that step. Oh, yeah, there's a dance called the Tush Push, and that's good old country music. You can go anywhere in the world and go line dancing, and if they call the Tush Push, you can go dance it because it's the same thing everywhere you go. Line dancing, when you're line dancing, there are no mistakes in line dancing. If you go in the wrong direction, we call it a variation. Unless you use some operative words out of your mouth that tell us you made a mistake. Nobody needs to know. You just keep on going. That's what fake it till you make it's all about. You just keep faking the dance until you actually have it and you don't have to think about it anymore.
Yes? Enough to fake it.
Most people will know a dance fairly well the third time through.
Remember, people, if you need help on stuff, 9 o'clock on Wednesdays and Fridays.
It just kind of teaches you that it's okay to have your own life and to do something you enjoy, even if it's only a couple of hours a week.
That audio essay was produced by Morgan McCarthy. You're listening to Sidetrack. For 34 years, Kevin Felici worked radio ops in the military. After 9/11, Kevin served another 7 months of active duty, and that provided him with a financial boost that allowed him to start constructing his dream space, the ultimate garage. More from independent producer Laura Spiro.
Kevin Felici's garage is nothing like yours.
It's 40 feet deep, 30 feet wide. It's got a 60,000 BTU heater, hot and cold water sink. It's got an enclosed toilet.
Did we rip down how many trees?
Yes. There were 6 large trees, approximately 60 feet in height, where the garage now stands. They had to come down.
And a 10-foot rhododendron that the deer love to go potty behind.
Cable, phone lines, internet, This is what I call a high-end garage, because there's been no expense spared doing what I've done in here. The garage, as you see it, actually cost me more than the house did.
The birth of this masterpiece can be traced back to sometime during the 34 years that Kevin spent doing radio ops in the military.
I started out in the Pentagon. Then I went to Bowling Air Force Base, then I went to Andrews Air Force Base, then when I got out of active duty, I went over to
Roslyn. He moved around a lot. It would be hard for anyone to feel settled.
You know, you always think about the things you'd like to have. Think about where you can put things, what you can do with things. And like I said, I've always wanted a garage. All the houses I've ever had, never had a garage.
Just a few years ago, Kevin finally got the opportunity to make his fantasy real. But it didn't happen in a way he could ever have expected. And definitely not in a way he would have wanted.
Actually, he was in Italy when the towers came down. And when he came home, the first thing that happened was, now you're assigned, and you're going to ground zero.
Kevin spent 7 months on active duty after 9/11, and his service provided a financial boost that allowed him to start building. Now, at the beginning, he had no intention of building an extremo garage.
Basically a box is what I would have built.
But once he got started, one thing led to another.
And then it just kind of developed.
It developed. I went top of the end with everything. I just got crazy with myself. 24 feet of cabinets, upper and lower.
But if I had the cabinets, then it has to be spaced that you can open the cabinet doors without hitting a car.
I'm very, very meticulous about my cars.
And I want to be able to put a snowblower in and my motorcycle in.
This is 3/4-inch tongue and groove plywood, 16-inch on center. This is like solid. The inside, the outside, vacuum, clean.
Well, if I'm going to be out there, I want a television.
It's also three separate sets of lighting in here, so you don't turn them all at one time. If you're working in the back of the garage, you turn this switch on. The middle of the garage, turn that one on. The front, you turn this on.
He bought a special mop for the garage.
Gail's actually a really good sport, and she and Kevin have a fair deal. She wanted the outside of the garage to match the house, so with the red cedar shake and peaked roof line in place, she's happy to turn the inside over to her husband.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The outside's the outside. The inside's mine.
I kind of knew from the beginning it was a guy thing. This is his space. It's white, gray, and black. It's man colors.
Guys would go, this is a garage. Oh my God, this is a garage. This is a dream. If I could ever have it, this is what I would have. It's going to have surround sound too. And quite a few people that say, you know, what are you going to do with this garage? I said, I don't know what I'm going to do in this garage.
He doesn't know what he's going to do with this garage. Yeah, after all that effort.
Well, aren't you going to work on cars? No. What I would love to do is get the computer out here, get everything cataloged in the computer, so that if I need sandpaper, I go to the computer and say, sandpaper, and it tells me it's in cabinet 3, shelf 2.
There's a word, putz. He can come out here and putz around. All I ask is that he put an intercom in, because I don't want to have to call his cell phone when I'm in the house going, your mother's on the phone, pick up the phone.
Which is also cabled for. I have everything.
Kevin's garage isn't about doing things. It's about having a place to put things. It's a huge indulgence, and he knows that.
I spent a lot of time overseas, and to see where some of these people live, you know, and to think about a garage like this, it's very, very selfish. But
as a daydream and escape?
Yes, exactly. You know, the ultimate, would I like to have it someday?
We're talking maximum potential.
That's it. You know, it's no building a car or building a box or building a cabinet. I just want to have the opportunity that if I want to do something, I can do it out here.
And when he does need a hammer, it's going to be really easy to get to in Cabinet 21 on Shelf 8.
That story from Laura Spiro first appeared on Weekend America and was edited by Hillary Frank. With a sign on the front said Fender Jam and a second-hand guitar. It was a Stratocaster with a whammy.
You're jamming Joe's garage. His mama was screaming, turn it down. We was playing the same old song.
This is Sidetrack. We are all familiar with comic strips and comic books, but some people feel what is seen in the mainstream media does not represent the full spectrum of voices the art form has. Damian Duffy and John Jennings are two such people. They are co-curators of an exhibit now at the Krannert Art Museum called Out of Sequence, Underrepresented Voices in American Comics. It runs until January 4th. I met up with them this week and had them show me around the exhibit.
I'm Damian Duffy. I'm co-curator of the show, out of sequence. And I'm also a PhD student in library and information science.
And my name is John Jennings. I'm also a co-curator of the show Out of Sequence, and I'm an associate professor of graphic design here at the University of Illinois.
So tell me a little bit about the show here.
Well, okay, the original intent was to kind of fill in the gaps from this show that we saw called The Masters of American Comics that was generated from the Hammer Museum, UCLA. And it was 15 of the greatest comic book artists to live, you know. But we found it severely limiting as far as like the canonical aspect of the show. It was like all men, you know, 14 white men, and then one minority maybe, you know. And we were like, well, there are a lot of other people's stories that should be told. And there are a lot of other aspects of comics, the medium of comics, that weren't really dealt with, we thought, properly in that show. So we wanted to try to create an exhibition that was a little bit more inclusive, a lot more inclusive, actually, you know, and focus not just on the artifact, but also on the medium of comics. Because most people look at comics as a genre and not a medium. You know, look at like superheroes or like funny animals, but they don't really look at the potential of comics as a medium.
Because of that, the show ended up having 65 artists, 214 pieces, and it's a really it's a broad survey of comics, all the way from early 20th century to contemporary. And also it's a broad range of styles, many different people making comics. We have women artists, minority artists, gay and lesbian artists, and then also many different ways of distributing comics. So we have independent comics, web comics, gallery comics, comics made just for museum spaces. We have virtual reality comics in the canvas in the basement of the Krannert Museum. We have educational comics, every manner of comic people don't normally think of as comics.
So it's more than comics you see in the newspaper or comic books.
Yeah, there are some of those too, generally by women or minority creators. And then it's also just many, many different other forms, different styles, different uses of the medium of comics, which is just taking images, putting them in sequence to tell a story, and mixing image and text.
So at the tables we have, this is Brummett Echohawk's work. He is probably the most, I think he might be one of the only possibly the only Native American cartoonist, and we definitely thought it would be great to have him included in this show. He's pretty very talented. I mean, very talented storyteller, and he was about to get syndicated, I guess, in the 1960s, but the syndicated comics, they wanted him to like make it really, really stereotypical with like Native Americans like attacking stagecoaches and stuff, and so he decided not to do that, you know.
Because the strip that we have original art from here is called Little Chief, and it's very much sort of a positive, showing Native Americans in a positive light, mm-hmm. talking about just Native American art, and also just having a very kind of kind, easygoing sense of humor. It's, you know, you see like the little Indian chief, the little Native American chief, cutting ice in one piece, and instead of the ice hole he's cut falling through, it's the rest of the ice falls through. So it's just kind of a gag, mm-hmm. And he's just sort of a very likable character. So it was sort of almost subversive in its way because it went against these sort of mainstream stereotypes, mm-hmm. And we thought it important to include, particularly at University of Illinois, where stereotypes towards Native Americans are sometimes problematic.
Right. So this is Jerry Craft's work. This is Mama's Boys. And we have original work from Jerry Craft. It's a self-published piece about an African-American mother raising her kid to two sons.
Well, here's one down here. When we were talking about African-American comics, yeah. Curtis, which actually is syndicated.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Curtis is by Ray Billingsley. And it basically is a story about pretty much him and his brother, you know, and their antics. And again, it has this really kind of lighthearted, more traditional comic kind of theme. When you think about comics, you think about this kind of, you know, gag strip or this kind of like kind of story-based illustration. But he's extremely good storyteller too, I think, as far as like stylistically too. And just we met him at the Festival for Cartoon Art, and he was really, really excited about getting his work shown in the museums. You know, that was actually part of the problem of getting, you know, a show together like this, is that all the artists are their own managers and stuff, and so it's kind of hard to get them to work together. You know, but he was really on point about it, and just a really great guy and beautiful work.
Yeah, we should mention that he is the nicest human being like on the face of the earth. He's so nice. Such a nice guy. Great to meet him. But also, Curtis is a really important strip since there are so few African American protagonists in newspaper comic strips. So that was another reason we were really happy to have his work as part of the show, in addition to just his great talent as a cartoonist, which you can see with just looking at his ink lines and the many sort of delicate weights that he uses. It's just beautiful work.
Why don't we go towards some other ones here, modern ones, stuff.
I don't like Mark Staff Randall's installation comic.
Yeah.
He was actually just here. He's a...
What are we looking at?
We're looking at basically an installation comic, and it's installed into the space. It uses the conventions of comics forms, but they're made to be seen in a gallery, pretty much. There's also like a standalone spin rack that has a bunch of little paintings that kind of, again, borrow from the culture of comics. And Mark Steph Brandel, like I said, he went to school here, and now he lives in Switzerland. He's shown all over the world, actually. And it was just here, and he did the artist talk. But a lot of the things he's done, basically what we're looking at is like the corner has a book painting on it.
Yeah, the corner of the gallery here.
Right, and it's a book painting. And in the book, he's actually like these separate stretch canvases that stand in as panel structures, right? And so there's a story about this woman being pursued by a thought balloon, pretty much. And so then it's funny because the balloon, which is an abstract concept, is actually real. And so it hits her, and then she blows it up and pops it. Oh, she blows up another one, and then starts, and then she lets the other thought balloon go, and so it's almost like this kind of circular kind of story going on.
And then also, he's painted directly on the wall, footprints walking off into the distance of the wall, mm-hmm. And all along the ground where the footprints are sort of broken word balloons or flattened word balloons, and he came and just painted it directly on the wall. Yeah. And then the work in the magazine racks—they all look like little comic covers. But they're actually supposed to be his footnotes for the show. So some of them refer to us by name as curators. They refer to some of the ideas of the show, talking about different comics. Or they refer to his own work, which is called Carried Away, because it's the woman being carried away by her thoughts.
People can like interact with these, too, you know, and actually pick them up and look at them, you know, and put them back into the, like they're browsing through them, you know. It's really cool.
Like the old racks you would find in...
Like Junior Food Market or Stop and Go's and, you know, little... Toast some stores and stuff, you know. Yeah, I love this.
Okay, so what else do we have here?
We have this original work from Alison Bechtel's really famous.
So who is this again?
This is Alison Bechtel. These are process pieces. This is the ink work, and the we're looking at the kind of like shading, the gouache shading that goes with the ink pieces, which are drawn on like tracing paper, and the final piece. Now, Fun Home is a autobiographical. Even though she refers to it as a tragicomic, like a graphic memoir kind of piece, it's about her coming out of the closet as a lesbian and her father's being in a closet as well. And basically, it's called Fun Home because she grew up in a funeral home. And so she just kind of cut off the funeral, and it's like Fun Home. And it was, who said it was good? Times Best?
Yeah, it was Time Magazine's 2006 Book of the Year, so not just graphic novel of the year, but Book of the Year. Yeah. So this particular page that we're looking at is... It takes place later in the book when Allison is going to college and she's sort of coming to grips with her homosexuality. She actually looks lesbian up in the dictionary at one point and then reads about other lesbians in books. She's very sort of bookish in her description of herself in the autobiography. Mm-hmm. And there are many sort of literary references. It's a very kind of dense book. And this is a really nice example of seeing how it was put together.
Yeah, there's something else, too, that's what we focus on in this show is that process. A lot of people will see the end result of the comic, but they don't know, you know, they don't know what a comic book script looks like or how it's colored or this kind of thing. And so we wanted to focus on those kind of aspects as well, just the culture, but also, like, the production of comics, because this is a populist form and it's meant to be reproduced. And it's Ann Telness. This is a piece actually on gay marriage, and she's a political cartoonist, but she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning political cartoonist. And so people like that we thought were really... You know, good to have in the show, just to look at like the breadth of experience and the breadth of like people, you know, people's expressions in the medium.
What is it about the medium of comics that is so effective in dealing with the messages that these artists want to project?
That's a good question. I wonder if there's something about the immediacy of it. Like anyone can do one. Like right now, we can actually go down. If you have a pencil and some paper, you can make a story really quickly. There's also this idea of hybridity between like text and image, where it kind of is a hybrid medium, and it deals with you know with with just society in this really interesting way. I mean, it's almost like it hacks into society, to if you want to use like terminology like that.
Especially in America, it's a very marginalized art form in a lot of ways. And we had been talking about this, I think John read in a Bell Hooks book, where she's talking about by being on the margins, you're able to sort of protest mainstream culture.
Right.
So comics, because it's sort of on the margins, it lends itself to subversive or very unique or very idiosyncratic ideas. And I think also just the fact that putting images and text together is such a powerful means of communication. Because it speaks on multiple modes. It has multiple modes of expression. So you're not just talking through text, or you're not just talking through image, but you're combining them, and combining them in a way that can be read, that's very interactive, that gives the reader a chance to think about it.
And there's also the sheer power of the democratization of, like, just representation. You know, it's abstractions of, and it's very symbolic, too, so you can do, like, these really interesting things with symbols and stuff. But also there's an aspect of it that's really highly collaborative as well. I mean, we're collaborators, you know, on comics, but some comics are, like, 8 people or 3 people or what have you. But then there's the collaboration of the audience. Because it's a cool medium, to borrow from, like, Marshall McLuhan, you're projecting a lot of yourself into it, the audience, and then there's also this kind of performative aspect to it. Like you are definitely each one of those characters, and you're reading through them, and it's all this time based and stuff. So it's all, I think it's like a lot of different, it's a mixed bag of stuff as far as like just a pop culture.
And it's very kind of synesthetic, because there's sort of words and word balloons are mimicking sound, or sound effects are mimicking sound. So in reading that, you're sort of making sound going in your head, and you start to read the pictures and see the text as picture. You know, so there's sort of that blend between image and text where you're not quite sure which is which sometimes. So it exists at this kind of crossroads of meaning that allows for a lot of experimentation. And I think that's another reason why all the work in here is very interesting and very provocative, and all of it very different from other work in the show, is because there is such a space for experimentation within the comics medium.
Yeah, I agree.
That was Damian Duffy and John Jennings, co-curators of Out of Sequence, Underrepresented Voices in American Comics, now at the Krannert Art Museum. The exhibit runs until January 4th. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and of course you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.